www.themouthmagazine.com.
Right, well, this is the Mouthcast, and we're out on De Grey Street in Hull, home to one of the UK's most enigmatic venues, which has been operating from what appears to be little more than a modest Victorian terraced house for a staggering 30 years. Almost a who's who of alternative music has passed through its doors, in fact. Radiohead, Oasis, Stone Roses, PJ Harvey, Manic Street Preachers, My Bloody Valentine, Supergrass, Pulp, The Wedding Present, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Blue Tones, Martin Stevenson and the Dainties, Robin Hitchcock, John Cooper Clarke, Shed Seven, The Pastels, Happy Mondays. I could probably go on for several hundred or even thousand more. Well, they've all played the 200 capacity club. Local heroes, the House Martins, even signed their record contract within its walls. It's 30 years this week, in fact, since the club began its musical life, having been taken over by today's guest. There are a whole host of celebratory events planned, including special shows this coming weekend by Kaiser Chiefs and Paul Heaton. And at the Paul Heaton show, Richard Hawley will be performing a DJ set. But tonight, I'm here to talk to the driving force, the visionary at the heart of it all. The venue, Hull's New Adelphi. My guest, Paul Jackson.
What a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling all around the sun. What a beautiful dream that could flash on the screen in a blink of an eye and be gone from me. Soft and sweet, let me hold it close and keep it here with me. And one day we will die, and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane over the sea. But for now we are young, let us lay in the sun and count every beautiful thing we can see.
Welcome to the Mouthcast, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
You were 30 years old, working as a shipping clerk, something that you've been doing for over a decade, and the idea of taking over a venue, and at that time, not what would be considered a particularly salubrious establishment, did that come out of the blue, or was that a long-term ambition that you'd had?
I was bored of working in industry. I wanted to do something that I was interested in. I wasn't going to move into the most expensive premises in the city because I didn't have the money. Initially, I started looking with two other guys, but very rapidly realised that I didn't like sharing decisions three-wise.
You can't be visionary by committee, can you? That's the thing.
You can't. No, absolutely. So I went it alone and ended up with the cheapest place in town, which has turned out to be an absolutely fantastic music venue.
So the long-term aim really was to get off the career path that you were on. Was it like you'd seen the next 30 years, if you like, if you'd sort of stayed in that thing? Were you looking for the unknown, the unusual?
It was a step into the unknown. It was an adventure at a time when I was still young enough to embark on an adventure.
Well, you remortgaged your house and took a loan from a brewery. Mm-hmm. Despite the sort of let's see what happens philosophy, you were obviously incredibly serious about making the place work.
I was able to impress people. I mean, you know, you can't get sort of 50,000 quid out of a brewery without convincing them that you're in some way competent, you know, and that was without ever having worked behind a bar before. So I was pretty determined and convincing at the time, yeah.
And the path, if you like, from the first idea and this building being available to opening, how long did that take you?
5 months, 4 or 5 months.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty quick yeah. Yeah, pretty quick. I mean, the three of us had looked at this place. And then I thought, no, I'm going to do it myself.
Well, the building itself had actually been a club for a while prior to... Well, it was a laundry for a while as well, too, I believe.
In the 70s, yeah.
You know, it had been the Adelphi Club for about 6 years before you opened as the New Adelphi. Mm-hmm. I guess the culture of the place will be different to what you wanted it to be. It must have taken a bit of effort to
I was a bit of a bull in a china shop, but yeah. It wasn't that difficult. You know, what I inherited was a working men's club night with a gay night, which meant that the working men were afraid to come anywhere near the place. And people still refer to the Adelphi as the gay club. And the gay night, which actually was a gay Sunday lunchtime, was actually a third of the turnover at that at the point when I started. And that was from seven lunchtimes and seven nights a week trading. You know, we had some pool teams, we had some dominoes teams, we had some darts teams. And that they had a resident covers band who played on a Saturday night. I think they lasted 1 week, and the dominoes teams and darts teams pretty soon after. We did keep a pool team going for some time because I quite enjoyed playing pool. But, but that social club element fairly soon disappeared, and there weren't many people using the place anyway. You know, it was just basically gangsters distributing drugs off all docks, you know.
Was there much opposition locally to the idea of a music club?
Not initially at all, no. I think they were pleased to see the place in new hands, and anything would have been better than the fighting and stuff that characterised the previous place.
Can you remember the opening night?
There wasn't an opening night as such, really. As in a sort of grand opening ceremony or anything like that. I just came into a working operation and adjusted things fairly rapidly. You know, I was programming my first bands after a week or so. Within about a month, we were probably doing two or three nights a week.
Who were the first bands?
First band that played was a band called Vagrant. Second band was a band called Cold Dance. Diana, the singer, lived around the corner from me in Cottingham. Kevin, the drummer, went on to become tour manager of the Pixies. And the third band were the House Martins.
Well, the House Martins actually signed their Go Discs contract here, didn't they? On stage.
Indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sustainability for a venue like this, there are often, with venues this size, there are often problems with regard to actually being able to stay open.
Yep, I know all about that. It's precisely the sort of place that can open up in cities anywhere in the world, and they open up, everybody thinks they're fantastic, and then they get closed down within a year, and it's one of those places, but you know, we've managed to keep it going.
For 30 years, which is...
Yeah, which is a miracle, yeah.
On a wing and a prayer at times.
It's very, very difficult financially. You know, I certainly couldn't have supported a family or anything like that. You know, large portions of the year, as in summertime, you know, you've just got several months where you're constantly trying to work out, right, who's going to send the bailiffs in next or last? Who's going to send the bailiffs in last? And it is very stressful, yeah. It's very stressful indeed. And yeah, you know, there will be a point where I consider that I can no longer sort of deal with that. I mean, the other thing I've found as I get older, and I am an old fucker, is that as your capabilities diminish, as everything takes a lot more time. I've also got an 87-year-old mother who needs, deserves, and gets a couple of hours of my attention every day, so I'm less able to sort of defend myself if the men in suits come for me. But there'll come a time when I feel unable to defend myself against the men in suits, and that'll be the time when, if I don't sort of pack it in, it'll be the time when I get into a lot of trouble.
What do you think you'll do if that happens?
I can't do anything else.
What will happen to do?
But I can't do anything else, but the feeling of being thrown against the wall by men in suits is one of the most desperate feelings. You know, I mean, because we don't make any money, we sometimes have to cut corners, and that can get you into trouble. There's no morality involved. You know, the main principle is to keep a very important place going, but you do cut corners from time to time. It's an absolute inevitability. And as I say, that can put you at odds with the men in suits, and it can be very, very difficult. You know, once they get the smell of blood, they're pretty ruthless and desensitised. And
Terminators, really.
Always lacking in an overall sense of concept.
Mm.
You know. People who wouldn't know culture if it jumped up and bit their arse. So.
Well, your role in this place has obviously been, well, it's more than a role, isn't it? You know, in many senses.
It's been me.
But there must have been times you've dreamed of getting away from the place. But as you say, you don't really know what you'd do if you did.
I've got a few ideas.
Yeah?
I mean, I've reached that point where it would probably be some form of retirement, perhaps some sort of consultancy work, but yeah, you know, there's a reason why the Adelphi has been such a cosmopolitan place, and I think I'd like to do some travelling, if it's all possible, because I've done none. I like to be out in the country, I like to be a part of a landscape, be it fishing or walking, stuff like that. I'd like to do that while I'm still just about able.
Because you actually live above the venue, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you have a good sense of what this place, and therefore what you, yourself, have given to not just music in Hull, really, but music in the UK?
I think I've created, and it's... Yeah, you know, I've been at the centre of it, but it's always been collaborative. There's always been numbers of people involved. All this stuff, it's been paid for and staffed and done by people outside the Adelphi, you know. People who, if you were to talk to them, they'll tell you that they grew up at the Adelphi.
Yeah.
And that's one of the characteristics of the Adelphi, more than any other place, any other licensed premises, music venue or whatever. People talk about the Adelphi, they talk about having grown up here. The pre-1990 Students' Union's criteria that has been central to our cultural agenda since day one. When I started here, Hull, probably a bit of a one-horse town, rare to see anything other than a white face. You'd have meetings with councillors, and you realise that they had this little kingdom of Hullites sort of within the inner city boundary of Hull, and that they were surrounded by all these foreigners, you know, the Cottites and the Beverleyites and the Hedonites and the Willabites and Heselites and so on, and they were all out to get them. They were very paranoid, and I mean, they were the foreigners. I mean, anybody with a coloured face, I don't know what they thought, but it was a town characterised by low horizons, and it's changed a lot over 30 years. It's now an exemplary modern city that people enjoy visiting. And I think that by engaging and joining successive generations of local sixth formers and new inputs of students from around the world, the Adelphi's played a big part in helping that process. I think the Adelphi's been very important. Yeah, you know, and I'm not saying that you're claiming total responsibility, but I think the Adelphi's played a big role and also set a template for other places to follow, as other places have followed and would admit to having followed. The Adelphi's a very, very important place, and I think could be held up as an example of good practice in terms of running a music venue with a cultural agenda.
Circuit that the Adelphi is part of, the circuit for bands in their early days, if you like. Mm-hmm.
It's also the circuit for bands when they're at their best, because when they become established and start playing stadiums, they're usually way past it.
I mean, the last thing I saw here, it was somebody who's never going to sell millions of records or anything like that, but you're absolutely guaranteed to see something that you would not see elsewhere. It was Thomas Truax.
Thomas Truax, yeah.
So I'm guessing over the years you've seen loads of things like that that bear no relation to commerce everything to do with art.
Yep, art, musical integrity, yep.
Yeah, are there particular ones that have stood out for you? Too many to mention, probably, but...
Well, all right, you've got to get a load. Well, there's the Moonflowers and Shonen Knife. These are the 30 greatest shows that went on tonight. Melt Banana, Extra Life and Counting Coins. My Bloody Valentine, Thin White Rope and Bob, back in the 80s. We had a show once by War. The other one is Townes Van Zandt. Somebody else who's amazing live, Hawksley Workman, along with Hamel on Trial. We had the Ann Peebles Band, which was a 12-piece, fantastic. did Leatherface and PJ Harvey once.
What was that like?
She was terrified. Pulp, Dig This Drill and AC Temple, classic one. Vic Chestnut and his band. Acid Mother's Temple 3 or 4 weeks ago. Joshua T. Pearson of the Lift 2 Experience, one of the most interesting and talented people on the planet. The Colourblind James Experience, Jeffrey Lewis Band and the Danielson Family. African Music, Ifang Bondi and Thomas McFumo and Umbeera's Unlimited. This Is the Kit and Soyan Caballo. Franz Ferdinand, A Hawk and a Hacksaw, Yatkar and Clinic. Yatkar were from the Tuvar province in Siberia. Throat Singers, The Friendly Fires, The Lars, Kingmaker and Radiohead, Carla Bozulic and Evangelista, Big Sam's Funky Notion, The Mary Hampton Band, that's folk, Pavement and Sulaco, The Gargoyles, Peter Roan and the Roan Brothers, Thunder 500, and Gregor Sampson. So there you go.
That's quite a list.
It's quite, well, you asked for it, didn't you?
You will have a keen sense, perhaps, of which bands have it. You know, Radiohead, for instance, I know you're a fan of Radiohead. Did you feel at their gig that they were obviously going to go somewhere?
Very much so. Very special band. Really nice guys who we loved working with. And, yeah, one of the genuinely great bands of the last 20 years. And a band who are still capable of making great albums. I have a criteria for great bands, which is that they've got to make 3 classic albums. And it's actually quite rare, but Radiohead have done that. They're one of the great bands.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know, for instance, Oasis never made 3 great albums.
No. One
Stone
and a half.
Roses didn't. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's quite unusual to find 3. Pixies are another band who did it.
You just mentioned Oasis and the Stone Roses. Mm. The Roses played to around 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
Oasis, I think, was it the night before their debut single Supersonic came out?
It sold out,
the place was packed out. And The Fall as well, legendary 10-minute gig here.
10 minutes, well, at least he spread his 10 minutes out over about an hour. There were several sort of minute to 2 minute bits in between vomiting and pissing his pants and shitting his pants and falling over and God knows what. Yeah, it wasn't a great advert for The Fall. No, lots of the people there said it was the best Fall gig they'd ever seen.
It makes you wonder what the criteria for a good gig is then, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, It's, I didn't quite understand it, but I was just a bit disappointed because I actually quite like The Fall.
Later this week, Paul Heaton is actually making his return. DJ set from Richard Hawley as well. Mm-hmm. Kaiser Chiefs on the Friday night, lots of other things, Fonda 500.
Yeah.
All of these events set the Adelphi up neatly for the next generation of gig-goers in the town, across Yorkshire, in fact.
Mm. I've always seen it as a regional venue rather than a
wise venue. The whole celebration is celebrating a legacy and securing
it. It is,
Which must be great for you.
It's a lot of fuss, and I don't like fuss very much, but
I can tell. I can tell as we're saying it. So, I suppose, if you had to sum up the Adelphi, my guess is that you'd say it's about the music, but more than that, it's about the people.
Yeah, and I'd say that, I do find it genuinely moving that people talk about the Adelphi, they talk about it as the place where they grew up. And that could be attributed to the fact that, I did sort of mimic this pre-1990 Students' Union thing, having been inspired by this thing of people, young people from all around the world leaving home for the first time and converging into this social world in which they became independent for the first time and embarked on a very rapid process of becoming what they were going to become while at university. And I wanted to emulate that while throwing young local people into the equation as well. That's been the case now for 30 years, and it still works and it still regenerates itself. And it builds up this legacy of the Adelphi family. We get 40th birthday parties and 50th birthday parties and things these days, which are sort of quite unusual. But people feel, this is where I was brought up, this is where I grew up. And they have to have their sort of birthday parties here.
What about you? What, on a personal level, is that what it feels like for you? You know, that you, in a way, you've grown up here as well.
In a way, I have, yeah. I've immersed myself 100% into doing this place, up to and beyond the limits of my capabilities, and I'm sort of very proud of what I've achieved here. I think those achievements are plain to see for anybody who understands.
Well, thanks very much for your time, Paul, and although you don't like fuss, happy 30th birthday.
Thank you very much.
www.themouthmagazine.com